And now I welcome Arjan van Hattem, who will tell us a little bit about the post-mortem of XS for All, its struggle to stay alive and its ultimate demise. A round of applause for Arjan.
Thank you, everyone. The date is January 10th, and the news breaks that KPN has decided to stop operations with a number of brands, including Access for All. The Access for All organization will be fully integrated into KPN, and the brand will cease to be. In a matter of hours, the Access for All help desk is swarmed with calls of support and appreciation. Social media is overwhelmed by customers and sympathizers that express their outrage. An action committee is formed, a petition is started that ultimately garners more than 50,000 votes to keep Access for All. And this all kicks off an incredibly turbulent year marked by formal procedures, demonstrations, media attention, public recriminations, and ultimately two separate court cases aimed to preserve Access for All. In December of 2019, however, the courts rendered their verdict and KPN could proceed. After more than 25 years of internet history, Access for All would cease to be. Hey, I'm Arjan van Hattem. I've worked at Access for All for 14 years, from 2007 to 2021, in a number of positions, but more importantly for this talk, between 2010 and 2020, I was involved in the Workers' Council, including 5 years as the chair, and ultimately serving as an advisor in the year of 2019. So it's from this perspective that I will go through the presentation. What we'll cover is the history as it pertains to the position and status of Access for All within KPN, the actual events of 2019, then some analysis, trying to see why it happened as it did, and then ultimately I want to leverage that into a little bit of wider social critique. And central to the whole talk is this question that I think has been in a lot of people's minds when at least this was present. How is it possible that a company that seemed to be in this type of sweet spot of profitability, social engagement, and employee and customer satisfaction was able to be dismantled so easily? And easily it was dismantled. Before we continue, a couple notes of limitations. If you're here, I assume you will know something about Access for All and its history. In addition, that history, I think, is too large, too complicated for any one person to fully understand, so I can only relate from my own perspective, and it will therefore be limited to a degree. Also, due to the restrictions of the time format, there will be elements and details that have been lost. I should also clarify that when we're talking about the demise of Access for All, that's in the context of Access for All as its own organizational entity, its own management staff and tech stack. Access for All as a brand, of course, continues to be operated by KPN to this day. So, having said that, I think we can dive a little bit into the history. Early years of Access for All, I think it's pretty well known, founded in 1993, idea turned out to be pretty popular, grew very fast, and by 98, you see, it's actually a normal organization with 50,000 subscribers and even running a healthy profit. Despite this growth, the original ethos kind of remained a little bit anarchistic, maybe a bit chaotic, but very idealistic. Around that time, however, what you see is that the broader market is changing. Dial-up is becoming a thing of the past, and broadband is the next big thing. And at that time, there was not necessarily a requirement for network operators to open their network. So if you wanted to do broadband, the way that would work is that you had to go to all the local exchanges, build up your equipment, connect the cables, route it through your data centers to connect it to the World Wide Web. That, of course, presents a significant investment to the point where for anyone but a large company, it's not really accessible. And as a result of that, the search for a takeover partner began. And to the surprise of many, I think, KPN became that partner, certainly to the surprise of the people at Access for All then. But there was a reason for that, because KPN, aside from also offering just the most money, committed to something nobody else wanted to, and that was a degree of autonomy. So in 1998, Access for All was sold under a three-year autonomy clause that left KPN with little to no operational control, and the governance was managed by a non-executive board of directors. In 2001, so when that three-year clause kind of ends, some discussions happen about, okay, how to do this next. And KPN then opts for a policy statement saying that to retain the brand image and identity, Access for All would retain its freedom to speak independently in the market and to the press, and to retain its innovative position, there would be freedom in technology choices. In addition, the director of Access for All itself grants the Works Council the right of inquiry to guard the independence of the organization. I'm not sure if you ever told KPN about that, actually. I think the acquisition at that time was really seen as kind of a combination of strengths, at least from the KPN perspective, offering that independence and retaining that. I think they really saw that Access for All did something that was different than they did, and that it needed to be autonomous to a degree for it to complement KPN and have that success. Following years, I think you can see there's a type of coexistence. Obviously, there's always going to be some discussions, but it's growth market, right? Broadband is expanding. KPN is growing its position as well. They're acquiring a number of providers, including Systron, HTCnet, and Demon, who are then chosen to integrate within Access for All. Access for All itself continues to do Access for All things, taking spammers to court, advocating for net neutrality, and campaigning against data retention laws. But I think then we start to see the sort of first fraying at the edges in 2007, 2008. Again, the telecom market is changing because cable companies now are coalescing into larger entities. These used to be regional players, and they're able to compete very strongly on speed. In addition, emerging technologies like voice over IP and WhatsApp, they're cutting deep into normally dependable revenue streams for SMS and call revenue. KPN has to respond to these market conditions, and you see that they're restructuring, there's layoffs, and they are selling assets such as E-Plus in Germany, which they had. To sort of illustrate how strong this pressure is, between 2008 and 2013, the revenue falls from 14 billion to 8.5. The headcount decreases from 36 to 23,000. And ultimately, in 2013, KPN itself faces a hostile takeover attempt from America Mobile. So the pressure was significant. Of course, at Access for All, we noticed that as well. To begin with, the pressure from the cable companies was noticeable in our own base as well. We engaged in a series of smaller cuts, restructurings, and system consolidations. Two of those, I think, are worth mentioning as examples, because in this period what you see is that the purchasing function is brought from Access for All to KPN. While in practice that makes sense, right? Because if you buy together, you can get a bit better discount, you save some headcount as well. But in practice, suddenly it means that all your decisions are now made by someone at KPN and in a KPN system, and the level of control over technology choices and partners significantly increases. Another example here is that at this stage, to reduce that headcount, the help desk staff were no longer able to receive Access for All contracts. Normally what you do, someone comes in through a temp agency, and after 6 to 12 months, if they do well, you want to offer them a contract, bind them to your organization, pay them a bit more money, they're happy, they're engaged, and they hopefully do a better job, and that translates to a better customer service. And this, you see, leads to discussions and some friction. And over time, and at least in 2013, that kind of escalates. It escalates to the point where the director of Access4All then leaves, is replaced by someone else, and a very significant cost reduction plan is put on the table, opting to remove 60 full-time employees, which at the time represents about a third of the full workforce, not counting the temp agencies, and targeting this time also what many consider the heart of Access4All, the technical departments. From the Works Council perspective, it's seen as unsubstantiated cost cutting. We were not opposed to cost cutting per se, but it had to be substantiated. And this led to a very difficult period of about 6 months with a lot of discussions, ultimately leading into a negative recommendations. Preparations for court were made, and we then chose to appeal our situation to the CEO of KPN, and that led to a series of fruitful discussions, and we were able to defuse the situation. By Christmas 2013, the plan was dropped, and an alternative approach was developed between the Works Council and KPN directly, which still included a number of restructurings and reforms, but not as drastic as the original plan. 2014 was actually, I think, a year that we spent a lot of time repairing sort of all the damage and fallout from that period. We got a new CEO and we entered discussions and where we kind of talked about what is the position of Access within KPN. And we developed a code of conduct, which replaced this 2001 policy statement, which centered still around many of the same things in terms of freedom of speaking to the press and own technology choices. But in the wording, you see, we kind of come closer to KPN again. Looking back now, I think you can say this period is definitely an inflection point, where before Access4All is this asset that does things that KPN can't, where you choose to place customers. Now maybe it's more a liability, a place that if you want to do stuff with, they kind of rise up and you have difficult discussions. You also see that during this time, we see that our public affairs manager departs the organization, and I think as a result also the engagement of Access4All in the public debate. If you were to look before 2013 and after, you'll notice a stark difference. Then we skip ahead to 2016. It was a project called Rio, and this actually was the predecessor, we later found out, for whatever happened in 2019. Basically, a team at KPN wanted to already integrate Access4All into KPN at that time. This was done on the KPN level, so the Workers' Council's Access4All was not made aware of that, and that makes sense. But in 2019, some of these plans surfaced, and we were able to reconstruct a little bit what happened. And what seems like that before it was the Workers' Council or the Works Council that tried to retain the identity of Access4All. Now it was the management team that engaged in kind of these difficult discussions, with a lot of the discussions resolving around, is it a valid business case? Does it make money or does it lose money? Ultimately, it seems to have been decided that it was not worth the risk because the plan was tabled. Having said, I think, now enough about the history, we can go forward to 2019. Actually, it's November 2018, because we're celebrating our 25th anniversary. It's a big thing. We put our brand or our logo on a ferry. It's a lot of fun. We have a big party at the Undercurrent in Amsterdam. Everybody who's ever worked for Access4All is invited. It's a big reunion. We're having fun. But all is not well, because just a few days later, the Works Council is informed that Access4All will come to an end. And we spend much of December and January preparing for that and how that then works, because it's a brand, it's a concern-wide decision that also affected other brands. For 3 days, you go to a hotel and you're sort of inundated with all these arguments and the business case and the reasoning over why, you know, you don't have a right to exist anymore in the market. The Central Works Council is then in the position to render its advice, and they advised positively, and that led to the announcement, of course. And it's here that we kind of see that this Project Rio kind of services and we learn about it. Where before it was kind of deemed not worth it, now suddenly it's an enormously positive business case. And I think at the time we just feel honestly overwhelmed and defeated. The aftermath, I think we saw, right, the petition, sort of the uproar. But what that did, I think it really caused a shift in perception. I think both within Access4All and KPN, as a works council, I think we no longer felt isolated. Suddenly it turns out there's a lot more support than I think we counted on. I don't think KPN really anticipated the amount of uproar either. And what seemed like an accomplished fact suddenly became a little bit less certain. And I think specifically because if you have 50,000 people, 80% of which came from Access4All IPs, I think was said, that signed that petition and this amount of uproar, that stands in stark contrast with the case that KPN then laid out to us, which was that, well, 6% of customers are going to leave, or about 14,000. And at that point, you kind of start to challenge the foundational assumptions that are underlying the whole thing. And in a response, what ends up happening is a lot of procedural wrestling. Because having received a positive advice from the Central Works Council, KPN then said, okay, we're going to now sort of go to the next stage, and we're going to ask you, the Works Council of Access4All, how we should integrate. And then we said, no, actually, you need to ask us if you're going to integrate. That's our position. And and that should be a full process. And in that process, we also need to look at alternatives like investing in the company, divesting from the company, keeping it is. It needs to be a full process and not just kind of a question of how. Ultimately, we agreed that we would do that. And I think at the time that felt like a procedural win for us. So having that win in the pocket, we need to briefly talk about what can a works council actually do. So the primary tool of any works council is the advisory right. And that means that on any large management decisions that affect the company to a significant degree, the idea is that the management will go to the works council and is going to explain the plans, kind of lay it out. And then the whole point is to come to a substantive discussion, right? Does this make sense? Does this work? So imagine you're baking a cake. The company says, we're going to bake a delicious cake. They're going to lay out all the ingredients. They're going to say, we'll put it in the oven at a certain temperature for a certain amount of time. And then the end result will have a nice cake. And then as a works council, you will say, okay, yeah, that makes sense because this is how you bake cakes, for example. Or you could say, we see that you've used about 4 times the amount of flour that you would usually use in the cake, and it seems to us then that the cake will not be very delicious, right? And then normally you kind of find each other and you have an agreement, but if you can't, then you have a right to appeal as the works council. And the way that works is that you can lodge these on the grounds that the entrepreneur, in weighing the interests of all involved, in fairness, could not have come to the decision concerned. So that is the advisory right. And on the other side, we have the right of inquiry, which was specifically granted to the Works Council. And that allows you to petition the court to start an investigation in the management and affairs of the company. You can also ask for provisional measures, such as reversing decisions, suspending decision, and even temporarily replacing directors. So, then I think we can look at our strategy, and I use the term loosely because you have to understand when you are in a situation like that, things happen fast and there are a lot, right? Aside from your own sort of emotional response to the situation, there's information overload, not necessarily information you feel comfortable with because it's not your area of expertise. You have to think about overarching strategies. Suddenly parts of the works council are talking to the media. You feel the pressure from sort of the company and your colleagues on you. So you're kind of pushed into your reactive stance. As far as we had goals and approach, I think it's very simple. We need to show that this is a bad plan, either by convincing KPN directly or by forcing them through the courts. But even if we had convinced KPN that, or they would have come to us and said, well, look, we agree it's a bad plan, even if that were the case, I don't think we could have gone back to the way things were, right? We're coming off this backdrop of a decade of friction, of us feeling limited. And I think even if we had gone back, it would have only been another 1 or 2 years before we've had the next sort of situation. So I think that informed a little bit of an all or nothing approach, and also informed the choice of the right of inquiry to use that, which we did, because we felt that over time KPN had disregarded the interests of access for all at the expense of itself. With the idea being, if either mechanism succeeds, then KPN has a problem, because they've told the world access rules are going to stop, we no longer want this, the shop is going to close, and now you're suddenly stuck with access rule, and you know, value could be leaving, because why would customers stay, why would new customers choose for you when you've announced that it's going to stop? And at that time, and at that point, it would perhaps make sense to divest or sell, at least that was our thinking. So, if we then go to the cases, we begin with the integration case. KPN's argument is laid out here. Basically, they said is internet is mass market. There's no way to differentiate yourself other than speed, price, and bundling services. And to do that, you need to be large, you need to be optimized, you need to be integrated. And in that world, there is no place for a smaller organization like Access4. You are not up to that challenge. And even if you're not failing now, which we weren't, you are going to fail. And so we need to preempt that and kind of integrate now. By the way, we're going to do that by retaining most of the value. We're going to keep most of the customers. We're going to keep most of your acquisitions. And all these distinguishing features in your product and in your brand, like quality, security and privacy, those will be transferred through the KPN brand through various means. How that looked like in terms of the business case, a loss of 6%, as we discussed. Also importantly, they said we're going to capture 86% of new sales. So imagine there's a market of internet providers, including Access for All. 100 people then choose for Access for All, take away the option of Access, and 86 of those people will then choose for KPN. Was the reasoning. Features will remain identical, there will be a fast integration of services, and will be minimal loss of secondary revenue streams such as web hosting and co-location. Count it all up, over 5 years, we get to 100 million euros. That is a lot of money. Our counter-argument was, actually, no, Access4 is a niche market. We have a unique position. It's based on brand identity. It's based on scale and approach. And these are things, if you try to integrate them into a large corporate, they will be necessarily lost. And as a result, you will lose access, access to that segment of the market, and you're going to lose a lot more customers than you would expect. And this is not just bad for us, it's also bad for you, so you shouldn't do it. Moreover, we think we can be much more successful than we are now, because we actually, to succeed, need to be loud, we need to be activist, we need to reach out to our community and our members, and it's certain restrictions that we feel that you've put on us that have put us in this limited position. So what we say, 6% churn, 86% sales is not realistic. Based on current evidence, you're not going to replicate all features, which they didn't. Integration is complex and takes a long time, which it did. And the secondary revenue streams are not insignificant. Obviously, we don't make that stuff up ourselves. This all has to be demonstrated from market research and information that you have. And we were supported in this creation of the business case by a partner called Finext, who specializes in that. So these were not just numbers that we pulled out of a certain place. In the mismanagement case, I think here we had two main arguments where we said, okay, KPN, you have just systematically kind of disregarded our independent interests in breach of that code of conduct that we agreed on in 2014. We gave examples where we said you have limited our ability to speak, participate in certain campaigns. You have made operational decisions on our behalf, and you've directed the use of certain KPM-branded or originated technologies. In addition, we also said, well, if you are making this argument that we are too small and that we're not prepared for this new market that is emerging where you need to, you know, be in a certain level of fitness to survive, well, it was your exorbitant profit extraction and lack of investment that perhaps then caused that, right? And we felt, essentially, you've kind of just operated us not as a distinct entity with its own criteria for success, but more as an extension of your residential commercial department. So we asked the court, order an investigation, please, from all the events and decisions up to from 2015, impose some provisional measures, including the suspension of the integration decision, and appoint a temporary director to sort this mess out. KPN's response, by the way, was very simple. They just said no to everything. We disagree on every single point. And the way that looks then, you know, you bring examples, they bring counterexamples, and then it's for the court to weigh and try to create an argument out of that. At last moment, there were some discussions just in 2013 as well between the Works Council and the management of KPN. But I think also due to the public scrutiny and heightened tensions and what was at stake, it was, I think, difficult to find an acceptable middle ground. And we ultimately went to the verdict, which was quite clear. The court rejected both cases, and in fact, if you look at the decision, KPN prevailed on nearly every argument. Contrary to their initial intent, however, they did choose to retain the AccessRoll branding, opting just to integrate the technology stack, where before they were thinking, okay, let's also discontinue the whole AccessRoll brand. And I think here what you see is that KPN is starting to, you know, maybe understand the situation was not exactly as they had hoped, and they're kind of hedging their bets. Having gone then through what happened, I think we can dive a little bit deeper into some analysis. So the big question is, of course, why did we lose? And in the integration case, I think there was it's very simple. In 2018, the High Court gave a ruling that kind of defined what type of test the court must use when it looks at these types of situations, and they call that a marginal test, which is a narrow implementation. And essentially what that means is that as long as the proper procedure has been followed, right, so we're baking this cake, as long as KPN has laid out the recipes, has told you how they're going to bake it, and that they want to have the intent of creating a delicious cake, and they've talked about that with you, it's fine. Because even if we then say, but hang on, you use that like four times the amount of flour and you also put some gravel in there, so clearly it's not going to be a delicious cake, that ultimately does not matter. It's not for the court ultimately to decide what is the definition of a delicious cake. I think what helped here is that also the way that they structured this is that during this particular advisory request, there were no consequences for personnel. So what they did is first we're going to have like an overarching idea, and then there would be smaller subsets of integrations that did have consequences for personnel. But because there were no consequences for personnel in this decision, that also changes the balance a little bit. Because if we think about that definition that we saw earlier, where the courts had to weigh the interests of all involved, or rather the entrepreneur, if there are no job losses, then clearly the interests of those involved are not being harmed to the degree that we at least thought. So with that, that case was just gone. We had hoped to demonstrate that the case was evidently wrong, and either we failed in that or the court declined to take a position. Then we had the mismanagement case, and there I think that We were kind of foiled by ourselves because they referred much to wording in the code of conduct that we agreed on in 2014, which said that Access4 would act as a full daughter of KPN, and that then transferred also some obligation to us to keep the wider concern interest in mind. And so where we had set out with the intent, we're going to demonstrate that our interests have been harmed, the court said, well, okay, even if that were the case, you haven't demonstrated that there wasn't an overriding or logical concern-wide interest. And with that, these arguments fell as well. And then lastly, we had said for a number of these places, we think that, you know, we were not, you know, KPN made some decisions for us. And the court said, okay, but if we look at the documentation, it was the director or of Access4 or Access4 itself that made the decision. And of course, that's true. Because any decision must logically come through the mechanism of the director of Access4, but that does not capture the informal decisions and influence that go before that. And because we were not able to demonstrate that in court, that pretty much tanked those arguments. So, I think it's always good also to think, where did we go wrong? And I think there's many examples to point to also in 2019, but I want to highlight, I think, the more systemic ones. And I think here is that as Access for All, as the Works Council, as the management as well, over the years we took a reactive stance to the situation. I think probably what we should have done is understood that within this large corporate, you're always going to be under threat, at least of them misunderstanding who you are. And we should have gone out and told them and convinced them and demonstrated our value continuously beyond just purely the number of subscribers that we represented. And we didn't do that, and I think we were happy to kind of sit back in our own bubble, in our own thing. And that ultimately then leads to a reactive stance where KPN then comes to you with, you know, a number of issues. And every time what happens, you then have to compromise, or you have to accept something, and sometimes you can, you know, bat something back, and you don't have to do that. But over time, you kind of negotiate away more and more of your independence. And then, when it mattered most, I think de facto we were already a much larger part of KPN than we ever thought we were. Another element I want to highlight is the asymmetry of power. I think we might say, well, obviously there was asymmetry of power, absolutely. But there are two specific examples just to illustrate what that looks like. And one of them was that because the Works Council consists of just people from the support desk, engineers, marketeers, all, you know, smart, dedicated people, they don't necessarily have the experience to analyze a business case or these grand strategic decisions. And so you need external support. And when we went to KPN and we said, look, we want to hire these guys to analyze your business case, and we need 120 hours for that, they said, oh, that's cool, but we're only going to give you 20, because you already had this other report done, which was more about the alternative plan for Access for All, that already cost a lot of money, and so now we don't want to do this, so you're only going to get 20. Meanwhile, at the very end of the process, they produced a report by Deloitte that counteracted a lot of our points. And I don't know if you know what Deloitte costs, but clearly you see how that could be a little bit unfair. I should note, though, that KPN did end up paying the guys, because we had to have that awkward conversation with Finext, our partner. We told them, we don't know if we're able to pay you. And they said, okay, that sucks, but we're going to support you anyway, because we really believe in your case. And if we don't get paid, we don't get paid. The other example here, I think, is how power extends. As you saw during this mismanagement case, we had difficulty capturing sort of what for us was a lived reality of how the dynamic between Access for All and KPN really worked, which on paper was not really present. So I personally reached out to a number of former managers of or senior managers within the Access for All team over the years, and I spoke to them. I said, well, look, I think we agree on these topics, right? We've spoken about this a lot, and would you be willing to testify to some of these things in court to kind of bolster our position? And they all basically said no. Reasons given, The place I work now has an active relationship with KPN that we don't want to jeopardize. I spoke about it with my senior management, and they don't, because of the public nature, they don't want our name involved. And the last one just basically was worried what it would do to their future as an executive if they took such a position. Of course, there was someone from KPN, from Access4 management, who did testify for KPN, but at the time they were actively working for KPN and managing a subsidiary of theirs. So here you see that in both cases, at least they were trying to do that, or we were denied something that they were then able to produce. None of this necessarily brings us closer to the root cause. I think if you step back, in 2019, we are at the third attempt in 6 years, backdrop of a lot of friction, and this friction begins with sort of the pressure of the market. Now, that pressure doesn't cause the friction, but it kind of reveals and amplifies it, because ultimately what we're talking about is just two organizations with distinctly different world views. And KPN comes to us with, from their point of view, reasonable requests in terms of optimization and consolidation, and to us, these are completely unreasonable requests because they reach the core of who we are. And that then kind of becomes a struggle over reality and common sense and what is true. And from that perspective, I think you can see two kind of rivaling frames emerge, right? You get sort of the KPN frame, which is like a corporate ethos. Efficiency and scale are important. There's a fiduciary duty to shareholders. Most of the value is in the network. That's where all the investment is going. And public engagement is important, but it needs to follow a low risk profile. And then you get the Access4 frame that says, no, authenticity and community relations is what defines us. And if we speak publicly, it needs to be authentic, and it needs to be engaged and be from come from who we are. And this then leads to two very definitions of this is how you run a business. And that dynamic over time, I think, can degrade a little bit, where it kind of deteriorates into a struggle of the mother KPN for uniformity and control over the daughter Access4. And then if you recognize that dynamic, the given arguments, right, the business case, the numbers, etc., they kind of become just touch points of contention which are legitimized, right? Because as a works council, we can't say, oh, well, KPN, they don't get it. They don't understand our customers, though, so they should leave us alone. And KPN equally can't say, oh, you know, Access4, they're kind of bothering us right now, so we need to integrate them. Those are not legitimate arguments. And if we take that perspective, I think we can also redefine success for KPN in this particular case. Because let's assume for the moment that they lost a lot of money on this. Ultimately, they did get that uniformity and control. They did get that deduplication of tech stack, and they were able to sort of have control over their own narrative and remove all that friction. Right. So now I think we can leverage this a little bit wider. If we then look, leverage it wider to critique, I mean. So to me, if I now look back, especially to the court case, there were a couple of failures, right? So to begin with, there's not necessarily a test for authenticity, right? A critical to this whole point where we're talking about we want the full analysis done is that we look at alternative solutions. But that theoretically can be reduced to a kind of performative exercise where on paper you said, well, I've looked at these alternative recipes to bake the cake, but I'm still going to go with the one that has four times the amount of flour. The court has no ability to judge the sincerity of that assessment. In addition, what it comes down to with that narrow definition, that marginal test, essentially what you're saying is that ownership defines truth. And that, to me, just sounds a little bit strange, because then you kind of get into an absurd situation where the court cannot follow the authenticity of the process or test the substance of the outcome. And that, to me, is a failure to capture the essence of what justice should be, and seems very problematic because, especially in situations of tension and high conflict, but often the court setting is, then the court, in my view at least, should be able to act as an arbiter. That leads me to my second point of critique. I think here, by defining ownership in this sort of as this deciding value, we engage in gross oversimplification. As soon as you simplify an organization purely to an object or a thing, then you're reducing it to something it's not. Because organizations are intrinsically human entities. They bring us together, they allow for growth and development, provide a sense of identity and belonging. And they, in a sense, are focal points or structures through which we express real human value, whereas the value of ownership is a construct, one that we've created out of necessity and usefulness. And to my mind, this ownership-centric approach represents a failure to encode real human values into the wider system. And this is also a type of misalignment, because in a liberal, pluralistic society, we say we have certain ideals, but the sort of measures we use then create very different outcomes. What then caused the end? Going back to our original question, I think here you can see the threat quite clearly. We have a small company on uncertain grounds in a changing market that presents is presented with this large barrier of entry, which then leads to a sale to a large corporate with intrinsically different world framing. And then these market pressures are amplifying that intrinsically different world framing, and you descend a little bit into that struggle over control and for uniformity, leading to a steady integration. And then when things ultimately really come to a head, a lack of standing emerges due to a failure to capture the relevant essences of justice and a failure to encode for real human values into the system. And here I think that while the end of Access for All was publicized and loud and visible, I have to wonder how many other organizations of value were either lost or diminished through similar dynamics. And necessary or needless, just or unjust, Access for All is no more, sad as that may be for employees and sympathizing community. Nothing is forever, and I think we had a pretty good run. I don't think any of the founders could have imagined what a wild and fantastical ride that idea could end up being. And speaking for myself, and I think many of my former colleagues, I'm just grateful that I've also been able to be part of that. And with that, I would like to thank you for your attention.
Yeah, thank you, Arjan, for this talk. And we still have some time for questions. So if you have questions, there's a mic. You can just queue there and ask your questions. Do we have questions from the internet so far? No, that's not the case. There's a question.
When is the book coming out?
Next year, all right? I'll write it, yeah.